It's called The Doll Tornado. In a room in Greensboro, North Carolina, a tornado of dolls touches down. Dolls form the spout and darken the room with all that has been pulled into the funnel of dolls that has sucked up also a telephone, a xylophone, and the dolls are either whole or missing limbs, missing eyes, or have eyes locked open and hair on end. They are naked and clothed, new and old. The dolls that can talk are not talking. The dolls that can wet are dry. The cloud of dolls is somehow suspended from the ancient factory ceiling on the third floor of a building that, if it ever caught fire, would go up like that. The dolls are no longer dolls. They are weather, storming into a room in the town where, down the street, a famous Woolworth's 5 and 10 is a civil rights museum. The lunch counter preserved where four black students waited to be served on the first day of February 1960. You buy a ticket to get in to see it, and you buy a ticket for the doll tornado. And it's worth the price of admission both times to see what is commonplace now as it thunders back down. It doesn't get much newer than this next short, which I did, a week ago. a week ago I was supposed to be here, so I did it a week before that, two weeks old. It's called Fort Bed, like a bed, but it's spelled with two D's. Okay, Fort Bed, two D's. The second D is silent. We agreed on that, if not on much else. In a darkened apartment on the east side of the park, when things went wrong, I thought about trees. I wanted lilacs and chestnuts, an onward pear, dogwood and silver maple, a copper beech so old that the bench built around it is splintered and gray. Trees take root, and I thought I could too, if I had enough trees to learn from. You'll tell me, he said, if I say something crazy. If I do something crazy, you'll tell me, he said. He was incurable. Old age can't be cured. We clung to each other for safety in the only safe place we knew. In the dark back bedroom, Fort Bed, the temperature of skin and air, we propped ourselves up on feather-filled pillows, and the wagons circled. But the wagons were pillows, too, so Fort Bed changed its borders with every move we made. The dark apartment rustled in the dark, and it was dark in the day as well. There would have been light if the curtains were opened, but they were his curtains to open, and he kept them closed. Sometimes, when we had kicked off the pillows and he was asleep, I would walk to a window and yank back the drapes the way an amateur diver might surface too quickly. Bubbles in the blood, pain in the joints, then the hyperbaric chamber of Fort Bed. If we were going to get through this, I would need trees. The next day or any day, I could slip away and drive to a nursery, pick out a tree, bald and burlapped, and put it in my car and take it to the edge of a field where no one would see me dig with the shovel I brought along. I could visit the tree I planted, bring water if it needed water. If there was dogwood blight that season, I could plant pendulum spruce instead, plant windbreak, woods, a forest, a glen. I've read this a few times in public, and so if you've heard it, apologies, but I also have a new ending from the first time or two that I read it. This is a story called A Full Service Shelter, and it's harsh. I worked for 2 years, almost 2 years, in the worst animal shelter in the Northeast and East Harlem. It's like the City Pound, and it's a house of horrors, in truth. And here's the thing you might listen for if you're interested in one of the students here. Everything in it is true, and I say that also to indicate I am not sensationalizing, where you might think I'm sensationalizing. And yet, why do I call it fiction? Why do I call it a short story? What makes it a short story fiction if it's all true, except for a couple gender changes? It has an epigraph. I hope you've all read the Leonard Michels story In the 50s, which is a great favorite of mine. He's talking in this sentence that is the epigraph. The speaker of the story is talking about the apes in a primate lab in a university that he cares for. And the quote is, "They knew me as one who shot reeking crap out of cages with a hose." Okay. "They knew me as one who shot reeking crap out of cages with a hose and liked it, and would rather do that than go to a movie or have dinner with a friend. They knew me as one who came two nights a week, who came at 4 and stayed till after 10, and knew it was not enough, because there was no such thing as enough at the animal shelter in Spanish Harlem that was run by the city, which kept cutting the funds. They knew us as the ones who checked the day's youth list for the names of the dogs scheduled to be killed the next morning, who came to take the death row dogs, who were mostly pit bulls, for a last long walk, brought them good dinners, cleaned out their kennels, and made their beds with beach towels and bath mats and torn sheets and Scooby-Doo fleece blankets still warm from industrial dryers. They knew me as one who made their beds less neatly over the course of a difficult evening, who thought of the artist whose young daughter came to visit his studio, pointed to the painting she liked, and asked, 'Why didn't you make them all good?' They knew us as the ones who put pig's ears on their pillows like a chocolate in a good hotel. They knew us as vocal vegetarians who brought them cooked meat, roast turkey, rare roast beef, and honey-glazed ham to top off the canned food we supplied that was still better than what they were fed there. They knew us as the ones who fed them when they were awake instead of waking them at 2 a.m. for feeding, the way the overnight staff had been ordered by a director who felt they did not have enough to do. They knew me as one who spoke no Spanish, who could say only, 'Sí, sí,' when someone said about a dog, 'I was walking, qué lindo.' And when a thuggish guy approached too fast, then said, 'That's a handsome dude. Look how we exploded another stereotype in a neighborhood recovering from itself.' They knew us as the ones who had no time for the argument that caring about animals means you don't also care about people. One of us did, Evelyn, a pediatrician who treated abused children. They knew us as the ones who got tetanus shots and rabies shots, the latter still a series but no longer in the stomach, and who closed the bites and gashes on our arms with crazy glue, not the medical grade, but the kind you find at hardware stores, instead of going to the ER for stitches where we would have had to report the dog who would then be put to death. They knew us as the ones who argued the names assigned at intake, saying, 'Who will adopt a dog named Nixon?' Excuse me. And when Nixon's name was changed to Dahmer, we ragged on them again. Then just let it go when the final name assigned was OG, Original Gangster. There was always a baby on one of the wards so that staff could write on the kennel card, 'No one puts baby in the corner.' And they finally stopped using Precious after a senior kennel worker said of a noble, aged Roddy, 'I fucking hate this name, but this is a good dog.' Though often they got it right. They named the cowboy-colored Pocket Pit, who thought he was a big stud, Man-Man. They knew me as one who did not bother wearing latex gloves or gauzy scrubs to handle the dogs in sick ward, who wore gloves only when a dog had swallowed his rabies tag and I had to feel for it in feces. They knew me as one who gave a pit bull a rawhide chew stick swirled in peanut butter, then, after he spit it up and wanted it back, cleaned it off and gave it to him so he could have closure. They knew us as the ones who put our fingers in mouths to retrieve a watch, a cell phone, a red bicycle reflector that a dog sucked on like a lozenge. They knew me as one who shot reeking crap out of cages with a hose, who scoured metal walls and perforated metal floors with trifectant, the syrupy yellow chemical wash that foamed into the mess and then towel-dried the kennel, and liked the tangible improvement, like mowing a lawn or ironing a shirt, that reduced their anxiety by even that much. They knew me as one who early on went to tell a vet tech the good news that three dogs had been rescued from that morning's list of 12, to which the tech said, "That blows, I already filled 12 syringes." They knew us as the ones who repeatedly thanked the other vet tech, the one who was reprimanded for refusing to kill Charlie, the pit bull who licked his hand when the vet, the pit bull who licked his hand when the tech went to inject him. And Charlie was adopted less than 24 hours later by a family who sent us photos of their 5-year-old daughter asleep atop Charlie, the whole story like a children's book, or maybe a German children's book. And we kept thinking the vet tech until he was fired for killing two of the wrong dogs, their 6-digit ID numbers 1 digit off. He didn't catch the mistake, but neither had the kennel worker who brought him the wrong dogs and who still has his job. They knew us as those who found them magnificent, with their wide-spaced eyes and powerfully muscled bodies, their sense of humor and spirit, the way they were first to the dance and last to leave, even in a house of horrors, the way stillness would take them over as they pushed their heads into our stomachs while sitting in our laps. They knew us as those whose enthusiasm for them was palpable, Rebecca falling in love with them at first sight, second sight, third sight, and Yolanda tending to them with broken fingers still in a cast, and Joy and the rest with their surpassing competence and compassion. They knew us as those who would sometimes need to take out a chihuahua, like walking an ant, Lori said, for a break. They knew us as those who didn't mind when they backwashed our coffee, when they licked the paper cup the moment we looked away. They knew us as the ones who worked for free, who felt that an hour stroking a blanket-wrapped dog whose head never left your lap and who was killed the next morning was time well spent. They knew me as the least knowledgeable one there, whose mistakes were witnessed by those who knew better. They knew me as one who liked to apply the phrase "the ideal version of," as in, "cure Chanel's mange and you'll see the ideal version of herself," but did not like the term "comfort zone" and thought one should try to move beyond it. They knew me as one who was unsure of small dogs having grown up with large breeds and knowing how to read them, but still afraid of the Presa Canarios, the Molossers bred in the Canary Islands, with their dark bulk and bloodshot bedroom eyes, since I had lived in San Francisco when a pair of them loose in a Tony apartment house had killed a friend of mine who had stopped to get her mail and could not get her door unlocked before the attack began. They knew me as one who called one of their number a dick when he knocked me over and I slammed into a steel bolt that left me bleeding from just above an eye. They knew me as one who guided them to step over the thick coiled hose in the packed garage that was being used weekly by a member of the board of directors to wash his car the city paid for. He never went inside the building. They knew us as the ones who attached a life-size plastic horse's head to a tree in the fenced-in junkyard backyard where the dogs could be taken to run off-leash one at a time and to sniff the horse's head before lifting a leg against it. They knew us as those who circulated photos of two pit littermates dive-bombing each other under the blankets of a bed to get closer to the large-hearted woman who had adopted them both. They knew us as the ones who took them out, those rated no concern and mild, also moderate and even severe, though never the red-stamped caution dogs. Although some of the sweetest dogs were the ones rated moderate, which was puzzling until we realized that behavior testing was done when a stray was brought in by police or a dog surrendered by his owner when they were most scared. Fearful is the new moderate. And how do you think a starving dog will score on resources guarding when you try to take away a bowl of food? They knew me as one who never handled the questionable dogs because that meant they could turn on you in an instant, you wouldn't know what was coming, and some of us got enough of that outside the shelter. They knew me as one whom Enrique had it in for, the kennel worker who had asked me to take out a 150-pound Ken Corso, and when I said, "Isn't he severe?" said, "No, he's a good boy." And when I looked up his card, he was not only severe, he was also DOH HB Hold, Department of Health Hold, for human bite. He'd bitten his owner. They knew me as one who forgave Enrique when he slipped on the newly installed floor while subduing a frightened mastiff, fell and punctured a lung. After voting to spend nearly $50,000 to replace the facility's floor, the board then had to allocate funds to bring in a crew with sanders to rough up the pricey new floor. The allocated funds were diverted from supplies, so kennel staff had to ask us, the volunteers, for food when they ran out, because feeding the dogs had not factored into the board's decision. They knew me as one who held the scarred muzzle of a long-nosed mutt in sick ward and sang, "There is a nose in Spanish Harlem," until he slept. They knew me as one who refused to lock the padlocks on their kennels, the locks a new requirement after someone stole a puppy from small dog adoptions, and which guarantee the dogs will die in the event the place catches fire. They knew me as one who asked them stupid questions. "How did you get so cute?" And answered the questions stupidly, saying on behalf of the giddy dog, "I was born cute and kept getting cuter." They knew me as one who talked baby talk to the babies and spoke in a normal voice about current events to those who enjoyed this sort of discourse during their one-on-ones. I told an elderly pity about the World War II hero who died in his 90s this year in a Florida hospital after having been subdued while in emotional distress by the use of a metal cage that was fixed in place over his bed. The posy cage had been outlawed in Eastern Europe yet was still somehow available in Florida. Caged in the space of his bed, he died like a dog, people said. They knew us as the ones who wrote Congress in support of laws made necessary by human cruelty and named for canine victims. Oreo's Law, Nitro's Law, the law for the hero dog from Afghanistan, and that's just this year. They knew me as one who loved in them what I recoiled from in people, the patent need, the clinging, the appetite. They knew me as one who saw their souls in their faces, who had never seen eyes more expressive than theirs in colors of clover honey, root beer, riverbed, and the tricolor cracked glass eyes of a catahoula, rare to find up north. They knew us as the ones who wrote their biographies to post to rescue groups, campaigning for the rescue of dogs that we likened to Cleopatra, the Lone Ranger, or Charlie Chaplin's Little Tramp, to John Wayne, Johnny Depp, and of course, Brad Pitt, asking each other if we'd gone overboard or gone soft like Lenny in Of Mice and Men. They knew us as the ones who tried to gauge what they had been through, as when Laurie said of a dog with shunts draining wounds on his head, he looks exhausted even when he's asleep. They knew us as the ones who wrote letters to the mayor pointing out that the Department of Health had vastly underestimated the number of dogs in the city to clear itself of misconduct for failing to license more. The political term for this is inflating their compliance record. They knew Joy as the stellar investigator who told the rest of us that the governor helped boost the state budget by helping himself to funds that had been set aside to subsidize spay-neuter services throughout the state. They knew that. They seemed to know that, just as they seemed to appreciate Joy's attempt to make a new worker understand that staff had not forgotten to write down the times they'd walked certain dogs, that the blank space under dates on the log sheets 3 days in a row meant that those dogs had not been walked in 3 days. When the budget was cut by $1.5 million, Joy began, but the new worker did not believe her. They knew us as the ones who decoded reasons for surrender and knew that don't have time for an elderly ill dog meant the owner had been hit hard by the ruined economy and could not afford veterinary bills. They knew us as the ones who doted on throwaway moms, lactating dogs left tied to posts in the Bronx after the owners sold their puppies, and the terrified young bait dogs. We would do anything for them, their heads and bodies crossed with scars like unlucky lifelines in a human hand, yet whose tails still wagged when we reached to pet them. They knew me as one who changed her mind about Presa Canarios when I found one wearing an e-collar that kept him from reaching his food. I had to hold his bowl up to his mouth inside the plastic cone for him to eat. I lost my fear of Presas. They knew me as one who had bully project on speed dial, who knew that owning more than 5 dogs in Connecticut was legally hoarding, who regularly fake pulled a much loved dog when I found that dog on the list, pretending to be a rescue group so that in the 24 hours it took for the shelter manager to learn it was fake, the dog would have that time to be pulled for real. They knew me as one who got jacked up on rage and didn't know what to do with it, until a dog dug a ball from a corner of his kennel and brought it to my side as though to ask, "Have you thought of this?" They knew me as one who learned a phrase in Spanish, "Lo siento mucho," I am so sorry, and used it often in the lobby when handed over a dog by owners who faced eviction by the New York City Housing Authority if they didn't surrender their pit. They knew me as one who wrote a plea for a dog named Storm, due to be killed the next morning, and posted the plea, and then went home to learn the next day that there had been 2 dogs named Storm in the shelter that night, and the one who needed the plea had been killed that morning. I had failed to check the ID number of the dog. So, this is not about heroics. It's about an impossible job. I joined them in filth and fear, and then I left them there. They knew me as one who walked them past the homeless man on East 110th who said, "You want to rescue somebody, rescue me." They knew me as one who saw through the windowed panel in a closed ward door a dog lift first one front paw and then the other, offering a paw to shake though there was no one there, doing a trick he had once been taught and praised for, a dog not yet damaged but desperate. They knew me as one who decoded the civic boast of a full-service shelter, that it means the place kills animals, that the full service offered is death. They knew me as one who learned that the funds allocated for the dangerous new floor had also been taken from medical, that the board had determined as non-essential the first injection, the sedative before the injection of pentobarbital that kills them. And since it will take up to 15 seconds for the pentobarb to work, the dogs are then made to walk across the room to join the stack of bodies, only some of which are bagged. This will be the dog's last image of life on Earth. My fantasy has them waking to find themselves paddling with full stomachs in the warm Caribbean, treading the clearest water over rippled white sand until they find themselves refreshed farther out in cooler water, in the deep blue reef-scarred sea. They knew me as one who asked another volunteer if she would mind holding Creamsicle, a young vanilla and orange pup, while I cleaned his soiled kennel and made his bed at the end of a night. I knew that Katerina would leave the shelter in minutes for the hospital nearby where her father was about to die. She rocked the sleepy pup in her arms. She said, "You're working too fast." She kissed the pup. She handed him to me. She said to me, "You should take your time." We were both tired and took turns holding the pup against our hearts. They saw this. They knew this. The ward went quiet. We took our time. A cheery story. What the time is it, Brown? I don't have a watch. I'll do one more that's shorter than that to finish. In a very different mood. I don't want to end on that note. This is, okay, where is it? Hang on. 1 second here. Okay. I don't think this was on the reading list that you gave people, Brad, so. Okay. This is a story called The Children's Party, and I still do, every August go up to a part of Maine where some friends have places on a small, like 3 miles around, lake, and one of the families had a place on this lake. The father was the amazing writer Paget Powell, and he's in here, and you know, having the imagination I do as a writer, he is not Mr. Powell, he's Mr. Howell. Okay, so those of you who know his work, just imagine him at your children's party. Bye-bye, the baby said, his voice a little bell. Bye-bye, he waved as we arrived for the party at the lake. We were stiff after driving from our house hours south in a town overrun by tourists. We put gifts on a table in the hall. The three children all had birthdays the same week. The baby's father showed us to the porch. He poured us drinks, said, "This'll change your handwriting." The others were friends from across the lake who came up for a month every summer, tying their bullseye or turnabout to a cleat and hopping out onto a dock. Between the back porch and the lake was a well-kept lawn with a grill, coals just lit, and a large decorated paper bag pinata strung up in a shimmering willow. The baby's mother and a woman I didn't know called me over to join them beside the pinata. The woman I didn't know asked if I had a match. I didn't see the cigarette she held and thought she meant to light the pinata. I told her, and we all doubled over, picturing melting gummy bears dripping like hot wax onto the outstretched hands of the blindfolded children beneath it. "Some little boy's scrotum get nailed to a tree?" asked one of the children's fathers from the porch. "I see three women laughing like this." He bent over, knees pressed together, and held his crotch. "I look for a scrotum nailed to a tree." Farther out, naked children pushed each other off a dock into the bracing lake. At the far end of the dock was a small child's slide poised above deep water. "I just put it there to scare his mother," said the baby's father, chuckling diabolically. "Look, he can go in by himself." Tony Peebles, handsome, hearty next-door neighbor, still had not arrived. "Heart attack," someone said. "Car wreck," someone else said. "Heart attack, then car wreck," came a chorus. "Talking to someone at the store," said his wife. "He went there an hour ago. I was telling Judy, he goes to pick up the steaks. There could be a stuffed effigy of the butcher behind the counter." Tony'd engage it in conversation. Only a couple of us knew it was taking so long. The children's dog had been killed the month before. The children felt it would be unfair to get another dog, unfair to their former dog. The children were in pain, and I felt I knew what to say. I said to their father, quoting a lovely poem, "Tell them this, quote, the need for the new love is faithfulness to the old." He said, "That's what I used to tell myself when I cheated on my ex-wife." But he'd agreed, and the men were picking up the children's new dog, a pup from a nearby camp. "I hope none of you are allergic," said the baby's mother, moving aside a vase of wildflowers to make room for a cake on a plate. "It's an allergy fest out there." "This cake, by the way, is real chocolate," she assured us. "I'm sick of trying to force carob on you and all of you spinning it out behind my back." Yet we saw that our health-conscious hostess was still serving the dreaded organic fig bars from the health food store in town. Colon blasters, we called them. The baby's father had said that colon blaster sounded like the name of an English soccer coach. "Tony's not back yet?" one of his friends asked. "And he made Bruce go with him," Bruce's wife said. "Tony probably told him there was something in town he had to show him, and he took Bruce to town, and the thing he had to show him was a stop sign." We ate deviled eggs while we waited for Tony and Bruce to return with the steaks. On the drive up, I told a friend we'd seen blueberries wild by the side of the road and birch bark peeling from the trunks of trees with towering crowns, but so far, we'd seen no moose. "If you come out with us in the canoe tomorrow, you'll see plenty of moose," she said. She described the stretch of river we would travel and the numbers of moose we would see, but no males with antlers. They're shy. You have to wait. You see them come out to look for females in the fall. The children called for us to watch them play with eggs. It was the game wherein you toss a raw egg gently to your partner a few feet away. Your partner tosses it back and you widen the gap between you. The toss and retreat is repeated until all but one of the pairs has broken their eggs. We watched, sipping drinks, until the baby's father called, "Eyes right," and appeared in the yard to the right of the house carrying a baseball bat. The children screamed with laughter as they took turns pitching raw eggs. "Jackpot," they screamed as the baby's father connected, splattering them all, including the neighbor's dog who had stopped by to cruise the grill. Mr. Howell, emboldened by the display, retrieved from his car a sack of sheathed hunting knives. But other of the parents blew the whistle on this. High stakes pin the tail on the donkey, not the same as batting eggs, and we strained to hear his gnarly utterances as he returned the knives to his car. "Deadlines," one of the birthday girls announced, excusing herself from the games. "I have deadlines," she said soberly, inexplicably adjusting a gorilla mask over her face. On the porch, in a high chair, the baby sent a bowl of Cheerios sailing off the tray. "Dinner is shoved," said his mother, kneeling to wipe up the mess. She returned from the kitchen with a jar of baby food and a clean spoon. "What's he eating now?" asked the baby's father. He picked up the jar and mimed alarm as he read the label. "Deadly poison." This made the children spit potato salad till their parents said to get a grip. Down on the dock, a brother and sister began yelling at each other until the girl ran to their mother crying, "Dan hit me back." "Dan has a temper. He takes after me," said their little brother sagely. "You mean you take after him," said their mother. "He was here first." The baby's mother picked up a small inflated raft in the shape of a giraffe. She pointed the long spotted neck at her husband and winked at him through the two small holes in the seat. "Imagine being able to fit your legs through these," she said. "I thought they were for your breasts," her husband said. Bruce's wife shushed him. We heard the distant, slightly hysterical cry of a loon on the lake. "People think they're related to ducks," said a local for our benefit, "but they're really much closer to penguins." "You go in the lake," said Mr. Howell. "Watch out for leeches, giant leeches. I had to nudge a moose this morning with my boat. He was eating the lily pads I planted, and he didn't move when I yelled at him to stop. When you ram a moose from behind, you got to be prepared for more than contact. He had a row of leeches on his butt, swung like fringe." "You see the fox last night?" a neighbor asked. "I seen a fox grab a leech off a moose's butt," said Mr. Howell, before we could shut him up. True. Didn't have to make that up. In the absence of Tony and Bruce and the steaks, we refilled our glasses and shared the children's hot dogs. I heard the baby laughing from inside the house and followed the sound to where he was having his bath. His mother made an ice cream cone of suds and pretended to lick it. "Ugh," she said, and the baby laughed again. I knelt beside the tub and scooped up a handful of suds, brought it to my mouth, and licked. "Ugh," I sputtered to the baby's delight, squinching my face in dismay. From outside, someone called us down to see. In the road beneath the streetlight was the young moose the children had named Moosifer. As we watched, the moose went down on its front legs, kneeling in the road like a camel, its tongue slowly rolling across the spot where earlier a clump of crows had pecked at the soft parts under the crushed shell of a box turtle someone hadn't stopped for. "It's Moosifer," one of the children whispered to another. Moosifer was a female, said our moose butt expert. You could tell by the absence of antlers. Then, "Eyes right," the urgent whisper of our host. We looked to the woods where something large was making its way through the trees toward the road. In the moment before Tony and Bruce drove up, the children's new dog barking in the car, locals and guests, we held our breath as branches broke. The magnificent rack, an emblem of need that could not wait another day. Thanks so much.